speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, the 25th of September, 2007. In for Sonali, I'm Aura Bogado.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Court interpreters on strike, an L.A. delegation to Gina, and Ahmadinejad in New York.
The tracks. Sorry if my eyes drop when the fellow meadows out, but I can't help myself. Why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Southern California court interpreters have been on strike for more than 2 weeks. 94% of Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, and San Luis Obispo Superior Court interpreters chose to strike, withholding their labor in what promises to be a lengthy battle. A large percentage of interpreters are not native-born, tend to be older in age, and even though they attained employee status only 2 years ago, the overwhelming majority of them have worked for the courts for more than 10 years. Those of them who interpret the major languages like Spanish, Korean, Armenian, and Chinese were required to pass a rigorous certification exam. The rest are registered interpreters. Because of their diverse backgrounds, certifications, and experience, they are in an ideal position to facilitate access to the justice system, not just for defendants, but also for victims, witnesses, and others interested in non-English proficient population. A new census report indicates that 53% of people in L.A. speak a language other than English at home. Although it's clear that interpreters provide an essential service, the workers say that court management refuses to treat them in the same manner as the rest of the court employees. We're joined in the studio by Sylvia Barden. She's the president of the California Federation of Interpreters, which is affiliated with the Communication Workers of America. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Aura.
Now, I want to talk about this original battle to become recognized as actual court employees. Tell us a little bit about that organizing struggle.
Well, I became involved once it was already in place, and there were colleagues who, for years before I came along, had been fighting to bargain with the management at the Los Angeles Superior Court, and when they were stopped pretty much at every turn, the realization that we had to do something through the legislature kind of came. It was something that we finally realized we had to do, and it was not going to be an easy battle. So we thought that the best way to be successful at achieving this would be to unionize. And when various unions found out that we were not even employees, that we were independent contractors, they kind of looked at us and said, well, that's a pretty big struggle. We wish you a lot of luck. Here's some water for your rallies. And the Communication Workers of America kind of stepped up to the plate, and they saw that we were pretty well organized, given that we were independent contractors. We had conducted walkouts already to demand a raise because we hadn't had a raise at that time in 10 years.
Wow.
So as independent contractors with no protections, we went ahead and conducted a walkout, got the attention of the Communication Workers of America, and they said, this group seems like a grassroots effort ready to happen. And I've been involved for about 7 years now. And when I came on board, we were already in Sacramento bargaining through the legislature to pass a law that was ultimately passed through Senator Escutia, who authored it. And the bill was SB 371, and it's now referred to as the Trial Court Interpreter Employment and Labor Relations Act. It was one of the last bills that Governor Davis signed, and it gave interpreters across the entire state of California employee status, and it also gave us bargaining rights. So in other words, the courts were finally forced to recognize us and treat us as the de facto employees that we had been for many, many years.
And for those of us who aren't so familiar with these terms, what are the essential differences between being an independent contractor and being an actual recognized employee?
Well, the IRS actually has a definition for what an employee is and what an independent contractor is. And we met most of the criteria. I've worked for the Los Angeles Superior Court for 20 years. Most of that time, I went to the same court every day. I was told at what time I needed to arrive. I was told at what time I could leave. I was told when I could take my lunch, when I could have a break. And also, I was told how much I would get paid. And for an independent contractor, you actually get to bargain every aspect, or you get to kind of cut a deal, so to speak, with your employer as to what your particular rate will be, what your hours will be, and so forth. And that's not the way that the court ever treated us, actually.
How did the court react when they realized that this was a serious move, a serious grassroots effort to organize these independent contractors into being recognized employees?
Well, our experience throughout the state was that, it's probably just not going to happen. We really just don't believe this is going to happen. And there were efforts made at the 11th hour to kind of try to thwart the passing of the law once they saw how far we had gotten in the legislative process. But I think that the sense of incredulity existed even up until the point when the governor signed the bill. So it kind of took them by surprise.
That's kind of typical, don't you think, for employers to sort of underestimate the power Well, in this case, it was independent contractors, but in effect, the people that they were employing, correct?
They did underestimate us, and we are finding that they continually underestimate us. You're absolutely right about that.
So let's talk about some of the struggles that you're facing today.
Well, as far as we're concerned, this is a continuation of the original struggle. The interpreting profession is a fairly new profession. I mean, I remember the days when I was told by the interpreters who started many, many years ago that in the beginning, so to speak, if people were brought literally from one of the restaurants down the street or, you know, a teacher that was bilingual, and it's like, can you bring that person into court? And, you know, I've got a non-English speaker here. And that was, for some people, the way it began, but I'm talking decades ago. And we're finding that even now, as we're growing as a profession, that it has been difficult to change the perception of who we are and how prepared you need to be to do this incredibly important work for the justice system.
Let's talk a little more about that. I know that I've traveled in Latin America with friends who, for some reason or another, don't speak Spanish or aren't fluent in Spanish. And while I'm happy to, you know, translate, it gets really kind of tiring after a few hours. And this is work that you're doing all day. I can't imagine what it would be like to have to interpret legal proceedings. Talk a little bit about that work that you do and who you help communicate these proceedings to.
Well, we're there to facilitate communication between the judge and the defendant and the attorney and the bailiff and the clerk and the court reporter and the witness and the victim and the children. We are the voice of everyone who's in the courtroom and who is speaking. That is what we do, and we have to get it right.
What kind of tests do you have to go through in order to attain, the interpreter status?
There's a very rigorous examination process in place, and the passing rate for the state exam to become a court-certified interpreter is just under 7%. It's lower than for the bar, and there's a very good reason for this, and the reason for this is because, like I just said, when you're interpreting in a death penalty case, or you're interpreting for a rape victim, this is someone's life who's on the line. And it's incredibly important that the people who do this work have the proper qualifications. We provide a constitutionally mandated service to the courts.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Sylvia Barden. She's the president of the California Federation of Interpreters, which is affiliated with the Communication Workers of America. We're talking about the ongoing strike of the court interpreters. I want to ask you, now that you've been on strike, what has the court done? What is the court doing essentially to try to replace these qualified interpreters?
It's pretty disheartening and astonishing to see what they've done. They're doing something called provisionally qualifying people who are bilingual. Some of these people are people who took the exam repeatedly and have not been able to pass it. Some people never even attempted the exam.
So that's almost like basically like having an attorney that hasn't passed the bar, or somebody that's maybe been in law school for a while and kind of knows some of the ins and outs but hasn't even taken the test. That's who the court is basically using to interpret what is really an essential language in these court proceedings.
That's actually a really great comparison, and you would think that it would resonate more than it has. I believe that part of the reason that it doesn't resonate as much as it should is because of the people that we serve, the community that we serve. They tend to be the poor, the marginalized, and it's difficult to understand the damage that's being done to this part of society, because unless somebody understands truly the work that the interpreter is doing, it is very difficult to understand all of the negative and damaging things that can happen to the people, not only who require our services, but to the integrity of the system. And it is disturbing to see that the court has been willing to bring in people who simply are not able to do the work.
Let's talk a little more about those people. A new census report indicates that about 43% of people in the state speak a language other than English at home, and 53% here in L.A. County speak a language other than English at home, myself included. Can you talk about some of the people that you have helped interpret for so that our listeners can get an idea of how essential and how important this service is?
Well, we interpret for every proceeding from children's court, where children are being removed from the home, where the only contact the child has with anyone could be the interpreter. That is how the child will communicate to the social worker, to the judge. We interpret for people who come here for a better life. Sometimes we interpret for people who come here with less than honorable reasons, and it's not very politically correct for some people that we interpret for defendants who have committed crimes. But we also interpret for parents in juvenile matters, where maybe the children understand, or the juveniles understand the proceedings, but their parents are going to be held accountable to make that juvenile comply with probation and sentencing requirements and so forth. And so we interpret for many, many people who come here and are just simply hard workers, anything from traffic cases all the way up to death penalty cases and drug cases. We handle thousands and thousands of cases a day in the Los Angeles Superior Court. It's the largest court system in the country.
Let's talk about what you're demanding now as court interpreters. What do you think you deserve, and why are you on strike?
We're on strike for respect, frankly. And one of the ways that respect is manifested in the work environment is in the way you get paid and the way you get treated at work. And we are the only group of employees within the court system that is not on a salary schedule. I have been working for 20 years as a court interpreter, and I met some really wonderful people who passed the exam in the last month and started working, and they earn exactly the same amount as I do.
Yeah, I find that troubling, to say the least, because in most professions you have this time-honored tradition of seniority, basically, as a concept, yet someone who's been interpreting for 20 years makes the same as somebody who's been interpreting for 2 months. Why is that?
Again, I think it's a lack of understanding and appreciation for the work we do. When we start as interpreters, we come in, many of us fresh out of interpreting school or out of some advanced program, and we start interpreting. But as you go through your years of experience, you begin to understand the nuances of how to do a better job at the witness stand, how to improve your skills, how to facilitate the communication. Based on your experience, we are in highly charged emotional situations. And it's the years of experience that really teach you how to handle the gravity of the work and how to do it in such a way so that you are... If we always say that if we're doing our job well, we become invisible, because our goal is to have the voice of the person for whom we're interpreting come across truly in their voice. And there's a true lack of understanding about what we do. And when we were in bargaining, one of the attorneys for the court once told us, this is the attitude that we face, he said, "Well, it's our belief that interpreters peak on the first day."
I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Sylvia Barden. She's the president of the California Federation of Interpreters. Interpreters have been on strike for now more than 2 weeks. And you just mentioned something that an attorney said, and that was actually my next question, was how do fellow employees treat you, not just daily, at work, at the courts, but in light of the strike? Are you getting any kind of solidarity from any of the fellow employees?
For us, it's always been a mixed bag. We have people who are very, very clear on the importance of our work, and they're very appreciative of it. And many of those include the attorneys on both sides, who appreciate having a professional, well-prepared interpreter, because they understand what that means when it comes to presenting their case. We also have people who look at us and say, "Why are you tired? All you do is talk." So it kind of covers the spectrum, and what we need is more of the people who really say, "Thank you for helping me to present my case in such a clear manner. I really appreciate that you were here for this important case today." We need more of those.
And what does your campaign entail?
Our campaign entails education. But the biggest part of our campaign is us saying no, no more. We're here, we're providing a critical service to the public, a critical service to the judges, a critical service to the attorneys, and it's time for us to be recognized and treated the way other employees have been treated for several decades now.
And how has court management reacted to this strike? And what excuses do they have for not wanting to grant a raise? Are they saying that the funds are simply not available?
Well, it depends on at which point in time you've spoken to them, because the story has changed as we've gone along. In the beginning, it was, "Oh, we'd love to compensate you accordingly, but, you know, the money's just not there."
And is it?
It's there. And we suspected that it was there last year when we were bargaining over salary, but we couldn't prove it. So we went to Sacramento and asked the right questions. And through the legislative process, through the budget committees, and through the Judicial Council, we were able to confirm that it is, in fact, there.
What other excuses has court management given you, and where do negotiations stand now?
Well, the biggest... obstacle that we see is that they finally just came right out and said, "We think you make plenty." And what was kind of left unsaid in parentheses is, "For you."
Right. And what about, are there ongoing protests going on? If people want to get more information about this struggle, is there a website that they can visit?
We have picketing at every major location in every major courthouse in the county. And we have lone picketers in Santa Barbara. And my hat is off to them for hanging in there. But for people who want more information on the strike and in general on the California Federation of Interpreters, the website is www.cfinews.org.
That's cfinews.org if you want to get more information about the ongoing court interpreter strike. I've been speaking with Sylvia Barden. She's the president of the California Federation of Interpreters, which is affiliated with the Communication Workers of America. Sylvia, thanks so much for coming in studio to talk to us about this important strike that's going on.
Thank you.
Coming up later in the program, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is in New York. But first, this radical day in history.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, September 25th in 1906, an angry crowd of white rioters in Atlanta, Georgia began to disperse, marking the end of a three-day race riot. Racial tensions had evolved into racial violence after multiple accusations were made that black men were raping white women. A group of vengeful white men quickly formed and began attacking black residents in what is now the Five Points downtown Atlanta area. During the mob violence, at least 25 black people were killed and over 70 were injured. Although the riot made it into the newspapers around the world, Atlanta's politicians worked hard to keep it quiet. They must have been successful, seeing as how this incident has not been taught in U.S. schools and the victims were never commemorated. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
That's the sound of thousands of protesters in Jena, Louisiana last week demanding justice for the Jena Six. The tiny town has become a symbol for the racism that is inherent in the criminal justice system. Reverend Al Sharpton was one of dozens who expressed his solidarity with the Jena Six.
Did you think you were going to lock up our son and start their names and then we wasn't going to say nothing? Did you think you could try this double level and double barrel injustice and that they couldn't get help? Just like there were those in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s that came to Louisiana to help fight for justice in 2007, we will come and we will keep coming until justice lays down like rock and righteousness.
That, of course, is Reverend Al Sharpton. In the latest turn of events surrounding the Jena Six, the FBI is now investigating a neo-Nazi website that lists the addresses of five of the six black teens, essentially calling for their lynching. Meanwhile, a multinational delegation is, a multi-ethnic delegation, preparing to descend on Jena next month to deliver a petition signed by more than 3,000 people demanding that the district attorney remove herself from the case. We're joined on the line by Dele Aleman. He's a representative for the Journey for Justice, the coalition planning the trip to Louisiana. Dele, welcome to Uprising.
Thank you very much, Aura. Indeed, additionally, the petitions that have been collected asking for the removal of Reed Waters, who is the district attorney for the LaSalle Parish in Louisiana. For a quick background, Reed Waters is the district attorney who had gone into the Jena High School to threaten the students of African descent in the school that he would put an end to their lives with the stroke of the pen if they did not desist from protesting over the case of the nooses that were hung on the trees in the school compound. He is still acting as the district attorney responsible in charge of this case. We are asking for his removal. We have petitions that have been signed, like you said, by about 3,000 people, and we are asking for more petitions that we are going to be taking to Jinnah for delivery on the 25th of October. But additionally, as we are speaking, despite the success of the rally that was held in Jinnah, Louisiana on Thursday, the 20th of September, which was viewed worldwide, the truth remains that Michael Bell is still sitting in jail. This was a young student who was 16 when he was charged as an adult in this very despicable story of racism. There is no other way to put it. The judge who is in charge of his case has refused to either lower his bail or to allow him to return to his parents while his appeal is on. So we're also asking that Judge G.D. Murphy Jr. should also be put should be put out of this case. These two people, Reed Walters and Judge J.D. Murphy, cannot be in charge of a case where they have become a party to this case by the actions that they have showed. The situation we're dealing with now, there is no other way that it can be examined. I mean, it unfortunately, despite the best intentions of all of us, the hanging of the nooses in Jinnah High School takes folks back to images of Mississippi burning, to Montgomery, Alabama. It takes people back to the stories of Selma. Unfortunately, as the world celebrates the 30th anniversary of the assassination and the murder and the lynching of Steve Biko in South Africa, at the time that people are celebrating what happened in Little Rock in 1957, where the federal government here had to force the desegregation of school. But within that atmosphere, we're not just talking of dinner. Around that area, a lot of we are witnessing situations of resegregation. As I'm speaking to you on the phone, in a town called Tuscaloosa in Alabama, there's a recent ruling which is putting people back almost a situation of resegregation. I mean, from 1896, with the case of Plessy versus Ferguson, you would think that those things are matters of history, and we have passed those areas. And we are not just saying that this is something that is happening in the South, like Brother Malcolm X who put it, that people used to say down South is all the place that this racism is taking place. But Malcolm said, actually, anywhere south of the Canadian border, you are down South, which means it includes Los Angeles. I mean, I am not a student of jurisprudence. I'm not a lawyer. But when you look at the three strikes crime, those are some kind of noses, I would say, on the neck of black and brown youth predominantly, and they're all youth generally. And so we are putting together, because it's not just a black situation, so we are putting together a multiracial coalition. We are asking for legal observers. We are asking for doctors. We are asking for education counselors. We are asking for priests, church ministers, people from the interfaith community to join this journey that is taking off on the 25th of October under the umbrella of the South Central Coalition and another coalition that is now forming, Journey for Justice, and Los Angeles for Jinnah 6, so that we can go and deliver this message. And our intention is not just to meet with the black youth. Yes, they are the first group of people being victimized in this case. But our intention is also to reach out to the white youth, because they are product of the unfinished revolution in the civil rights struggles that was conducted in this country. Unfortunately, we are calling on folks again to begin to get ready to travel south. 50 years after the passage of a series of civil rights acts in this country.
Now you bring up so many important points, and you're right, because 50 years after so-called civil rights, we are seeing a ton of racial injustice day in and day out. And as you say, it's not just in Gina. It's not in just the so-called South. It happens here in L.A. all the time. Can you talk about why it's important for people from L.A. To go out to Gina as part of this delegation?
It's very important because L.A., Los Angeles, is one of those towns, those huge metropolis, or people with a mega metropolis around the world that wants to project itself as an international city. Some folks who want to think of Los Angeles as the capital of the world. And we think it is important because as one of the cities that is leading in the peace movement, this is a war at home. Yes, we must call to the end of the war abroad, but from here, because of the multiracial, multinational, multi-ethnic diversity that we see in Los Angeles, it is time for us to live up to this bill that we want to, that we hold with so much pride, as if everything is, no, but we want to take this message from Los Angeles, which we told youths of all colors, middle-aged people, adults, those who have gone south before, to take a kind of to take an international message to Gina in Louisiana, and we are going to be bringing back a message from Louisiana, because the kind of terror to which youths are subjected, to black and brown youths in particular, in Los Angeles, also needs a message. It is just that this is a case that is happening with such high drama, if you want to put it that way, and it is something to which we have to respond to immediately. But we cannot forget that right here in our own backyard, if one is to put it that way, that things are not in any way settled. What happened on May 1 during the demonstration at McCarthy Park, it's not settled yet. Nobody has been given any kind of substantial response in terms of what happened there. The police chief in Los Angeles was reconfirmed. The mayor is going on about his life. So we have that. But for Dinner 6, it is that it is a depiction. When you talk of the nooses, you are talking of one of the most deadly and chilling symbol of Jim Crowism. To some people, it sounds unbelievable that this is still happening. But from the reports that we have so far, we understand that very little has changed in some of those small rural towns in the South. I mean, we're almost talking back of Soweto. Soweto in South Africa. It seems that is the situation that is being described. And we do not just want to visit Gina. No, the plan is that we are going to be establishing a permanent site of a human rights watch center in the town of Gina. Because the population of that place is about 3,000, over 3,000 people you would call white, and the population of the black people is just about 400.
No, Dele.
Yes, it's about 400. That is the demography of the place.
Unfortunately, we are starting to run out of time on this segment, and I do want to focus on this delegation. Again, I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Dele Aleman. He is with the Journey for Justice Coalition. It's a coalition that's planning a trip to Louisiana from L.A. Briefly, I have a couple more questions for you. Can you explain why it's so important that this delegation be multiracial?
It has to be multiracial because the struggle for human rights and civil rights is not something that has to be seen only from the perspective of blacks. The way the delegation and the whole marches and the demonstration around Gina 6 is taking place so far, despite the fact that most of the groups in LA have tried to do some outreach to the rest of the community, I do not think that the response has come up that way. When we arrive Gina, we want to see almost equal number of black, brown, youths, adults, and civil rights leaders coming out of the vans, of the buses that were taken to Jinnah, in order to send a message to the town of Jinnah that maybe this is what is happening in the rest part of the world, and also to begin to see whether we can have a permanent civil rights movement to respond to this kind of situation. So it is very, very important that it has to be multinational, multiracial. We do not think that this is just it is not a black story. No, it is not just a black story. We think it should involve people of other races. And we do hope that people will respond to this call, particularly the conscious progressive community around Pacifica.
And finally, Dele, I do want to ask you, how is this being funded? How is this delegation from LA multi-ethnic?
We're going to be leaving our phone messages. We have been happy that in the collection of the signature that has been done mainly by volunteers. But for those who will be going on the journey, if they call us on, if they email us on journeyforjustice@yahoo.com. Or if they call us on Los Angeles, if they email us on Los Angeles for Gina 6 as a figure 6 at Yahoo, they will be getting responses on the means by which they will assist in funding the journey to Louisiana. I mean, some of they will be expected to help pay for their bus seat. But I hope that is not going to discourage people. It is a generational obligation for activists today to be part of the movement to Louisiana. And of course, if we have your permission, we will also leave a phone number that people can call directly, in addition to the places where they can email us.
Please go right ahead.
Of course, the phone number is going to be for now temporarily is going to be 323-580-3008, and then in about 2 days they will have a website. But in addition to the telephone number, the 323-580-3008, they could email us on journeyforjustice@yahoo.com and losangelesforjina6@yahoo.com.
Okay, again, that phone number is 323-580-3008. You can also email journeyforjustice@yahoo.com or losangelesforjina6, that's spelled out S-I-X, @yahoo.com. Dele, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. Thank you.
Of course. I've been speaking with Dele Ailman. He is the representative for the Journey for Justice, the coalition that's planning a multi-ethnic trip to Jinnah, Louisiana. Coming up next, Ahmadeh Najad in New York. Stay tuned.
So I would like to say, let us be one in the future. Power to all of the people.
KPFK Pacifica Radio.
Can't pass the people, can't pass the hitman.
On the outskirts of Sao Paulo, the largest city in South America, four young black women struggle to fulfill their dream of living off their music. The dream takes the shape and the name of Antonia, the hip-hop group they formed together. But the four of them will need more than just talent to survive in a world of exclusion, violence, poverty, and male chauvinism. A warrior-like perseverance fuels each character in Antonia, the third feature film by Brazilian filmmaker Tata Amaral and the producers of Up Against Them All and City of God. Antonia, the KPFK Film Club's sixth presentation of September, opens Friday the 21st at the Lemley Music Hall, and KPFK Film Club members who call the station switchboard at area code 818-985-2711 and enter O for operator anytime during working hours will be sent a pass for two, good for any screening.
Amid protests yesterday afternoon, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad addressed an audience at Columbia University. He was introduced by University President Lee Bollinger as a leader who has behaved like a, quote, petty and cruel dictator. In his address, Ahmadinejad defended his nation's right to pursue peaceful nuclear technology while denouncing the abuse of Palestinian people. Meanwhile, mainstream media has focused a tremendous amount of energy to Ahmadinejad's request to visit Ground Zero, his speaking engagement yesterday at Columbia University, and his visit to the United Nations General Assembly. The Iranian president's request to visit Ground Zero was ultimately not honored, as Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said that doing so would have been what she called a travesty. John Lanyun of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows said of Ahmadinejad's request that, quote, if he really wanted to go lay a wreath, let him lay a wreath. I would object to him, as we've objected to any political figure using it for a political statement. Joining us today to talk about Ahmadinejad's visit is Stephen Zunis. He's with Foreign Policy in Focus. Welcome to Uprising.
My pleasure.
Now, I want to ask you, first of all, Stephen Zunis, does the amount of attention that's centered on Ahmadinejad's visit surprise you?
It does in a number of ways, particularly since Ahmadinejad is not particularly a powerful figure. The real reins of power in Iran are with the Ayatollah Khamenei and the Supreme Council of the Clerics. Ahmadinejad's also lost his grassroots base among the country's poor, and he originally ran as an economic populist and pledging to clean up corruption and the needs of the poor, but he's totally failed in all of those things. And he's certainly not commander-in-chief of the armed forces or anything that could threaten American interests. So I think he's really playing the role that Saddam played before him and Gaddafi before that, as the Middle East leader that Americans love to hate. To kind of help us feel good and self-righteous to justify our policies in that part of the world. Because, again, he certainly is not that key a figure in terms of political power and influence overall.
And what do you think makes him such an easy target, then, for mainstream media and for politicians like Condoleezza Rice?
Well, I mean, certainly his rhetoric has been quite inflammatory. I think, you know, the Holocaust denial was particularly offensive. And of course, people jump on that. I mean, I should mention that, when you compare, Iran's human rights record, of course, is very, very poor. But if you want to look at treatment of women, gays, religious minorities, fundamentalist rule, that kind of thing.
Well, Iran apparently, according to Ahmadinejad, there aren't any gay people in Iran.
But, if you want to look at that record, Saudi Arabia, our ally, whom we arm with billions of dollars every year, is worth of armaments, you don't hear similar objections when their leaders speak. We've had Turkish leaders speak who deny the Armenian genocide. And, 95% of Americans are being killed by arms from the Sunni insurgents, not groups that are allegedly backed by Iran. So all in all, it seems that there's a that disproportionate amount of attention on Ahmadinejad seems to be more for political reasons than anything to do with the very real concerns about the positions he's taken on a number of issues.
Yeah, that sort of begs the question, what type of parallels do you see between the rhetoric leading up to the Iraq War and Saddam with Iran and Ahmadinejad?
Well, they're pretty striking, actually, and I'd also, compare it with, the rhetoric against Gaddafi in the 80s that would lead to a series of airstrikes, not a full-scale invasion and replacement of the government, as in the case with Iraq, but it does... it's interesting because it puts progressives in a dilemma, because on the one hand, we don't want to defend and rationalize for these guys. I mean, these kinds of leaders who believe the things that they do the things that they do. On the other hand, their role is so grossly exaggerated that it ends up. It ends up fueling this call for war and military action and the overall agenda of the administration.
A few years ago, we kept hearing the war drum in relation to weapons of mass destruction, of course, which were never found in Iraq. And now we keep hearing about nuclear weapons and Iran's sort of idea that they are not using nuclear technology for energy, but instead planning to build a nuclear bomb. Can you talk about this and the way that Ahmadinejad defended his nation's right to seek peaceful nuclear technology?
Well, basically, everything that they're doing in their nuclear program so far, as far as the international community can tell, and they have the International Atomic Energy Agency has been allowed to inspect and everything, is within IAEA guidelines. The trick is because Iran tried to hide some activity from the IAEA some years ago, they were given these special restrictions that limit their rights to develop to engage in reprocessing and some other practices that other nations may do, and they have failed to abide by this exception given to them, and this ruling by the IAEA, and they do have the authority to make such exceptions and make such stricter rulings. Iran's defiance of this has led to a series of Security Council resolutions and mild sanctions to try to get them to go along with it. The problem, of course, from the Iranian perspective, is why are they being singled out? I mean, you have India and Pakistan, which already have nuclear weapons and delivery systems, who are violating UN Security Council Resolution 1172, calling for them to rid themselves of these missiles and nuclear bombs. Yet the U.S. blocks enforcement of that resolution, and sends nuclear-capable jet fighters to Pakistan and signs a nuclear agreement with India, not to mention Israel, which has been in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 487, calling for Israel to place its nuclear facilities under the trusteeship of the IAEA. And so why is Iran being signaled out when they don't even have nuclear weapons yet? They're years away from having that capability. And so he's been really being able to play on this kind of double standard. And even Iranians and other people in that part of the world who despise the regime and don't like Ahmadinejad in particular are rallying around him, are supporting him because he is playing the nationalist card and challenging the double standards of the United States and the West.
I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Stephen Zunis of Foreign Policy and Focus about Ahmadinejad's visit to New York. You bring up an interesting point. I want to ask you why you think that Iran is being singled out in terms of nuclear technology, especially in light of the recent nuclear technology agreement that the U.S. just signed with Pakistan.
Well, it's basically this idea of nuclear apartheid. The United States has traditionally opposed nuclear weapons-free zones and other comprehensive, universal, law-based means of proliferation. Iran has endorsed the idea of a nuclear weapons-free zone for the region. There are already nuclear weapons-free zones for Latin America, South Pacific, Antarctica, Southeast Asia, Africa, Central Asia. I mean, Southwest Asia, India to Israel, is the last part of the global south, really, that's not part of the nuclear weapons-free zone. And I think really the concern is that this nuclear program does have potential military applications down the road, and that is true. I frankly think the suspicion that they may have nuclear weapons ambition, that Iran has nuclear weapons ambitions, is a valid concern for the international community. The problem, though, is this idea that if they do have nuclear capability, I think the threat is not that they're going to do a suicidal first strike. I mean, Ahmadinejad's not commander-in-chief of the armed forces anyway, and it would clearly be suicidal. I mean, Israel, United States have enormous nuclear deterrence. But I think they're developing nuclear weapons, if indeed that's their goal, for the same reason every other country who has developed nuclear weapons has done so pretty much, this idea of a deterrence, that with these neighbors having nuclear weapons, with the U.S. having invaded their neighbor to the east, Afghanistan, the neighbor to the west, Pakistan, Iraq, there's concern that the that they need a nuclear deterrent. And when they saw their name on the list of the axis of evil around with Iraq, along with Iraq and North Korea, Iraq had gotten rid of the nuclear program, brought IAEA inspectors back, didn't find anything, but the U.S. invaded the country, overthrew the government, occupied the country anyway. North Korea, by contrast, threw the inspectors out and started developing nuclear weapons. They're still in power. Well, if you're an Iranian, you know, what lesson would you get from that?
Stephen Zunis, unfortunately, we are running out of time. Something that I haven't heard too much about in the mainstream press is the idea of diplomacy. Can you briefly comment as to why you think the United States didn't take this opportunity to try and create, publicly create, a diplomatic relationship with Ahmadinejad while he's here on U.S. soil?
Well, I think because the United States is not interested in a diplomatic solution. That especially people like him, as extreme and bombastic as their ideology is a good foil, you know, to justify American policy. The United States could pursue a way that could, help the moderate elements within the Iranian government and help the pro-democracy movement. But instead, by taking this absolutist stand and refuse to engage in negotiations, it just it perpetuates the crisis and ironically reinforces hardliners like Ahmadinejad. But the way I look at it, if we could make a deal with Libya, which basically said we'll stop attacking you and threatening to invade you and have normal diplomatic and economic relations if you give up your nuclear program, there's no reason we couldn't try the same thing with Iran. But so far, that's apparently not what the administration is interested in doing.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Stephen Zunis of Foreign Policy and Focus regarding Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's visit to New York. And for Uprising Subversive Thought of the Day, it's from Mohammed Al-Baradei, the General Director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who said, quote, "As long as you continue to have countries dangling a cigarette from their mouth, you cannot tell everybody not to smoke with a high degree of credibility." That's Mohammed Al-Baradei, and it's Uprising's Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our producer, and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website, which can be found by going to kpfk.org. From there, just click on Programs in the left column, scroll all the way down until you find Uprising's website. CDs of this program are available at www.pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprising.org. In Personal Eco Hot Car, I'm your host and producer, Aura Bogado. Thanks for listening.